Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Robert Talese, W. Alton Jones professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. His new book, Overdoing Democracy, Why We Must Put Politics in Its Place, is just out from Oxford University Press. In the United States in particular, there is almost no social space today, whether that's Thanksgiving dinner or going shopping, that has not become saturated with political meaning. In his new book, Talese argues that contrary to what many democratic theorists have argued, democracy is something that we can do too much of, and that it is in fact being overdone. Features of everyday life are overwhelmingly transformed into expressions of political identity, and this transformation undermines democracy itself, since it ends up undermining our capacity for civic friendship, or the capacity to see our political rivals as equals. Talese's book is a provocative contribution to discussion among political theorists about the problems facing contemporary democracy. And from a practical standpoint, it also suggests that a way to counter this situation is to consciously seek out social interactions and spaces where politics is off the table. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Robert.
Hey, Carrie, how are you?
Welcome. New Books in Philosophy. You've been here before, I think.
I have.
But anyway, so it is a pleasure to be talking with my co-host, actually, about your new book, Overdoing Democracy, Why We Must Put Politics in Its Place, which is just about to come out. So, as usual, I'd like to start with a bit of background about yourself. Tell us as much as you'd like, and then in particular, how you came to write this book.
Sure. So, I did my PhD at CUNY, as others have, in 2001. That same year, I got hired on the philosophy faculty at Vanderbilt, which is where I've been ever since. Enough about me, the book. I tell the story about how I came to write the book early in the book. Which is that I was having lunch with a friend who I hadn't seen in a while, sort of a week or so after our last presidential election in the United States, which I'm sure many listeners will remember was jarring for lots of us. And as we were talking, I came to realize that not only was she disappointed with the election results, and not only was she anxious about the future of the United States and what politically would be coming down the pike. She was also really anxious about the coming holidays. So she was to host a Thanksgiving dinner in just a few weeks, involving lots of her family members who apparently politically don't see eye to eye. And she, was really sort of out of sorts about what this family gathering would be like. And she told me that she had actually been reading newspaper and magazine columns that were offering advice about how to navigate political disputation over the holidays. And, you know, I just found that such a strange, it struck me as just strange that this holiday season in the States, we have Thanksgiving quickly followed by the Christmas holidays. So this holiday season that's supposed to be, among other things, about reconnecting with family was now this sort of generally recognized site of angst. And so I started looking at these columns that went out home online and started reading the columns about how to survive the holidays, given rancorous, you know, political disputes over the dinner table. And the advice largely was of the sort of normal type that one would expect, you know, lots of, by the way, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these columns. You can go Google surviving Thanksgiving politics and get 50 million hits. And, you know, the advice is this sort of, you know, middle of the road standard, like don't raise your voice, you know, don't take the bait, you know, be polite, you know, be sure to listen. And then it almost invariably gets into what like strike me as sort of dark places of advice, like if you can avoid going to dinner, maybe you should consider doing that. Try not to be in the same part of the room of the, as the people who trigger you. And so, again, I started thinking, wow, it's interesting that, you know, this is such a popular genre of holiday, column writing. And really it's a genre that thrives on, people looking to turn to complete strangers, you know, not therapists, not analysts, you know, just people who write for magazines and newspapers for advice about how to deal with their own family at an event that's supposed to be about reconnecting and reflecting with your family about a year, another year completed. And then it struck me that there was no piece of advice given in any of the articles that I read where the columnist just said, look, just tell your family that, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday is just not for politics. Nobody ever said that. And that struck me as odd. Just thinking like, well, surely there's a place and a time for, you know, real political argument and dispute. Would never think to suggest to anybody that those conversations and arguments, even when they're heated, shouldn't happen. I just started thinking, well, maybe they don't have to happen every place that they can happen. And maybe like many other things worth doing in our lives, political argumentation and disputation sort of has its time and place. And, you know, maybe the dinner table over Thanksgiving is just not the right place for that kind of thing to happen. So I started having thoughts of that kind. And then several months later, I got an invitation to do a TEDx talk here in Nashville. And so I did this TEDx talk called Putting Politics in Its Place. And I hadn't yet decided, I thought I might write a book about this, but I hadn't yet decided whether to write one. So I give this, you know, what is, I think, you know, it's an 18-minute talk or something. They give you, you know, fewer than 20 minutes for these events. And after the talk, somebody approaches me in the lobby of the venue in which the TED event was. And this guy says to me, I swear this is true. I don't know if this made it. I don't think this made it into the book, by the way. Guy comes up to me and says, well, professor, I agree with everything you said up there. I said, oh, well, thanks. That's great. He said, it was a surprise to me, though. I said, oh, why is that? And he said, well, I looked you up online and I saw that you're a professor of philosophy. And so I figured you'd be a liberal. And I thought, this is a guy who has inferred from the fact that he listened to me talk for 18 minutes and I still don't seem to have horns coming out of my head to him, that I must not be politically allied with his the rival team or whatever. And I thought, wow, that's given the content of the talk. And I'm like, this is a deeper phenomenon than I thought it was. So sort of when I had that interaction with the guy, I said, you know, it's probably now's the time to try to sort of work this up into a book. Which I did. So a lot of my research up until this point has been about democracy and, you know, sort of epistemic conceptions of democratic decision making. And then so maybe there's a bit of an irony in the fact that after spending, the better part of 20 years as a philosopher writing about democracy, I've finally gotten around to writing a book that recommends that, we sometimes do something else.
Okay. So, right. So, I mean, that's, right in the title, overdoing it. And the basic argument of the book is that, democracy is something that can be overdone. And that we are overdoing it. And that, because democracy is a good, it's maybe the least worst political system or however you want to put it. It's worth saving. So we need to stop right overdoing it. So I guess the first issue here, in the book you lay a lot of groundwork in terms of, what is democracy? Why is it a good, why is it a worthwhile system, one that should be that we value and we should value. And I invite you to say those things as you wish. But I guess the question, first of all, is just, what is it in your view to overdo democracy?
Well, good. So, I've been in the course of writing the book, and now that it's written and about to come out, in the course of talking about the book, I realized that the central thesis, it's possible to overdo democracy, or to put it more strongly, we are overdoing democracy, and that's bad for us politically, that's likely to be heard as the expression of some kind of anti-democratic sentiment or an expression of some kind of view that ultimately wants to claim that democracy is not such a great thing after all, or not so valuable after all. So the first chapter of the book, and in fact the first two chapters of the book together, are aimed at trying to show or trying to argue that it's fully consistent with a commitment to a robust and participatory conception of democracy to hold that democracy is the kind of thing that we can have too much of, or that we can do too much of. So let me just spell out then the overdoing part, mm-hmm. the too much part. It's pretty familiar. We're all committed to the thought that, when it comes to at least certain kinds of good things or valuable things, there could be too much. We can overdo cheesecakes because cheesecakes are, subject to diminishing utility. With every bite, the value of the subsequent bite is diminished. And there's a point at which another bite of cheesecake is positively displeasing. democracies, of course, are not cheesecakes, and their value is not like the value of cheesecakes. I don't think that democracy is subject to diminishing utility. But there's this other sense of overdoing a good thing, and a different sense of what it is to have too much of it. And that's the sort of crowding out phenomenon. And we overdo a good by way of crowding out when our pursuit of it, or our practice of it, or our enactment of it dispels other good things from our lives, or from are doing it to the extent that we are, prevents us from pursuing other good things. Now, the crowding out phenomenon is slightly different, though, related to just what we might think of as opportunity costs, right? The pursuit of the pursuit of anything precludes right. you from pursuing other things, right? So right. that's not the point, right? The point is rather that sometimes when we pursue a good thing to the exclusion of certain other good things, the good that we're pursuing suffers because the expelled goods are correlate or in some way necessary to realize the full value of the good that you're pursuing. So let me just give an example that sort of runs, I referred to a couple of times in the book. Another true story. I once had a friend who decided, sort of out of the blue, that she would achieve maximal physical fitness. And so she devoted herself in a way that was impressive just in and of itself to an exercise regimen that was really intense. And she achieved really remarkable results in a relatively short period of time. Now, the problem wasn't that she exercised so much that she wound up, you know, hurting herself. That wasn't the problem. The problem was that she spent so much time at the gym working out that she lost all her friends. We all lost touch with her. She was never around on the weekends. You know, nobody would see her at the normal places where people would socially interact because every aspect of her life was sort of devoted to the project and sort of organized around the project of furthering her fitness goal. And so there's a classic case of sort of overdoing something, it seems to me. It's this person whose sort of commitment to the goal of becoming physical fit actually looks pathological, it seems to me. But part of the pathology of it is not just that, you know, what's so great about fitness? You say, no, fitness is a really important goal. It's important to be healthy. Let's lay that down. And maybe it's important to be healthy for more than merely instrumental reasons. Maybe the good of fitness or of health is intrinsic. Maybe, you know, there's something about being healthy that's good just for the kind of good that it is. I think you could say all that about fitness and still say, but part of the value of being fit is that fitness enables you to do other things besides working out. Right? Mm. Fitness enables you to engage in certain kinds of rewarding experiences with others, to go on hikes, to travel, to do things, to tend to other kinds of activities in your life so that those activities are even more rewarding than they might otherwise be. And so in the case of my friend, it looked as if she not only put at the center of her life a goal that is, we're just hypothesizing, ex-hypothesis, totally worthy, but in putting it at the center to the exclusion of all else, the fitness itself became pointless. That is, she lost all the goods that fitness is for, one might say. And so in that way, it looked as if something pathological had happened. So she was in this excellent physical condition, but then the commitment to fitness expelled all the goods from her life that fitness kind of needs us to be able to pursue in order for it to be properly the kind of value it is. Now, so the thesis overdoing democracy is that democracy is that kind of pursuit. Democracy is a good, and I'm perfectly willing to say it's intrinsically good. You don't have to be a democratic instrumentalist, that is somebody who thinks that the goods of democracy are purely instrumental, to hold that democracy is a good whose profile is complete or is properly ordered only in virtue of the fact that it enables individuals to realize other goods. And so when democratic politics, when our political allegiances, along with our partisan animosities and hostilities, sort of infiltrate and become sort of embedded within the whole of our social interactions within everything that we do, we become sort of like my friend who overdid her fitness routine or overdid her pursuit of fitness, might be a better way to put it. When democracy becomes all we do together, we become less good at doing democracy and we lose out on some of the goods that are necessary in order to realize realize fully the good of democracy. Is that helpful?
Yeah. So what are, I mean, you kind of hinted a little bit social
relations. I mean, certainly in the analogous case of the exercise, right. You know, she exercised so much, she can no longer enjoy friends, etc. But so what are the goods that are being crowded out that democracy is supposed to, you know, is a good for?
So there are sort of two levels at which I think one might answer this. Democracy, if it's to thrive, and in fact, we might just say this sort of to, you know, political philosophy 101 thought about democracy, is that democracy is the proposal, among everything else that democracy is, right? Democracy is the proposal that a relatively stable, relatively just social order is possible among persons understood as citizens. And here we mean by citizen social equals. So democracy is the thesis that you can achieve a relatively just and stable social order without there being an elite ruler. You can achieve that kind of social order when the citizens rule themselves qua social equal. Now, what that means is that, or let me add one more sort of premise-y kind of thought. Part of what you're, part of what is involved in social equality, in sort of having a community of people who are social equals, is that, you know, when we're social equals, you know, we get to think our own thoughts and come to our own judgments and assess facts and claims and arguments and evidence according to our own best light, and nobody gets to browbeat us or intimidate us or dominate us into sort of subduing our own judgment simply because they think we'd be better off or would be more correct if we were to do so. So when you have social equality or people who are regarded as social equals, you're also going to have a lot of disagreement and a lot of political disagreement. And so democracy is the view that a stable and just social order is possible among social equals, despite the fact that they're going to be ongoing, persistent, sometimes heated disputes among the citizens about the precise shape of the political order. And so what democracy requires is a way, various ways of sort of managing disputes about things that matter a lot to us, like, you know, freedom and autonomy and justice and the great political values. Now, a lot of the institutional features of that are prevalent in democratic societies or strategies for managing ongoing political disagreement. But there's also an ethic of citizenship that's required for democracy to work well. And that ethics of citizenship requires of us as citizens, at the very least, it might require a lot more than this, but at the very least, it requires us to develop within ourselves the capacities and dispositions that will enable us to regard our political rivals as nonetheless our equals. And in this case, what that means is that if we're going to succeed at democracy, we have to be able to regard those who we think are committed to misguided political views within a broad range as nonetheless the kinds of people who get an equal say, but entitled. We have to see them as people who are entitled to an equal say. And so one of the goods that democracy needs in order to thrive is a kind of moral capacity within the citizens to see, even in their political rivals, virtues and merits of a sort that could underwrite their social equality, despite the fact that we have to regard them as politically misguided. So one sort of level of the answer to your question, what are the goods, is that in order to thrive, democracy needs for us to be able to see our political rivals as nonetheless our equals. When we overdo democracy for reasons having to do with two social phenomena that I take it we'll get to talk about in a minute, which is the polarization phenomenon and what I call political saturation. When we overdo democracy, we do things that dissolve that capacity, such that our political rivals, or we engage with one another in such a way that we are caused to increasingly regard our political rivals as inscrutable, as alien, as benighted, as depraved, and as threatening. And there's really robust data on this that the book gets into. And so when we overdo democracy, we lose the capacity to see our political rivals as our equals. And that means that democracy starts going badly, because then democratic decisions really just are a matter of the tyranny of the majority, or a matter of the tyranny of whoever, you know, wins the election if it's not majoritarian. And so you'll have huge parts of the population very pleased that they've gotten their way, but they've gotten their way simply by imposing their will on another portion of citizens who didn't get their way. And when democracy becomes just a contest for power, then we've sort of given up on what makes democracy even valuable. And I think that we've sort of weakened the case philosophically, weakened the case for democracy's merit. So that's one. Secondly, sorry. Secondly, you know, just go back to the Thanksgiving Day dinner stuff. You know, when we overdo democracy, we allow all of our social interactions to be sort of colored by or filtered by our political allegiances in such a way that we create opportunities and openings for division and enmity where they needn't be. And so if you think that one of the virtues of a democratic society, and say in contrast with an authoritarian regime, you know, you might think that, well, one of the things that makes living under an authoritarian, you know, so crushing is that you're constantly having to view your everyday comings and goings, your everyday activities, the things that you say, the clothes that you wear. You're constantly having to assess yourself and the minuscule aspects of your life in terms of how well they will square with the party line or with the authoritarian's dictates. And so one of the things that's so oppressive about authoritarianism is that it makes everything, at least potentially, if not actually, sort of a matter of political expression. When we overdo democracy, we invite into democracy a similar kind of phenomenon where everyday interactions become expressive of political allegiances and therefore ways of establishing borders and boundaries between people who might otherwise have, you know, a whole lot of ground upon which to interact about things other than politics. But those things get crowded out and politics becomes the main lens through which our everyday interactions occur. And so one of the things that democracy is supposed to provide for us is some relief from the idea that that politics has to be a 24/7, 365 occupation of us. It sort of gives that up and makes everything an act of democratic citizenship. And so other kinds of social relations, you know, relations of care and support and ambition and aspiration, attachment to things, become just more ways of expressing one's political allegiances. And as it turns out, with, you know, fairly robust sociological data, this is what's been happening in the United States and in the UK and in some other democracies in Europe as well. Workplaces, public spaces of all kinds, commercial spaces, hobbies. These have all become fairly tightly tied to political profiles, such that it's now the case that in the United States, we've got pretty good data on this. You know, the number of clocks that are in your home are a good indication of your political valence.
Really?
Yeah. The more clocks, the more conservative you're likely to be. If you have maps in your house rather than clocks or art, that swings liberal. Now, you might not be surprised by that kind of thing. You might say, well, these are different tastes. But when you start thinking about the ways in which ordinary interactions, ordinary sort of features of our life, you know, like what you do on vacation, do you golf and fish or do you lie on a beach? Turns out that these are really good indications of your politics. I just saw today, actually, a story on Vox where some lab had done an experiment with, you know, they had some modernist, you know, drawing, some piece of art that was modernist done in the 80s. And it looks like it's done in crayon. I'm not even remembering the name of the artist. I'd never seen the piece before. And it turns out that, you know, you just present people with the photo of this drawing and just say, is this art or not? If you say it's not art, you're far more likely to approve of President Trump than if you say it's art. So, politics sort of enters into our everyday sort of seemingly non-political behavior in these ways that sometimes are surprising, sometimes when you think about it, maybe not surprising. But what that means is that our everyday spaces, our everyday casual, unplanned interactions, just, you know, sort of chit-chat with the person standing behind you online at wherever you happen to buy coffee. We can get into talking about how, you know, where you buy your coffee tells a lot about what your politics are. But wherever you buy your coffee in the States, the person behind you online is increasingly likely to have voted like you. And so, you know, our interactions tend to sort of be coded and sort of organized around our party allegiances, which means our everyday interactions really just put us into contact with people who tend to be much like ourselves. And so, although the country, like other democracies, has become in the aggregate more heterogeneous and diverse in all kinds of encouraging respects, the local environments that we inhabit have become increasingly politically homogeneous in the past 20 years. And that just, that looks problematic to me from just realizing, the Democrat, that looks problematic to me from the point of view, just realizing the democratic ideal. That is, you know, we're more and more often expressing and engaging in behavior that marks our politics, but those behaviors are more and more enacted in spaces that are themselves, due to their homogeneity, not properly democratic spaces.
Okay, so good. So who are we here? You know, we talk about we. So maybe you could say something about who you have in mind when you're talking about we, and then also, you know, we are overdoing it. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, why we, whoever we are, are overdoing it? I mean, how we got to this space? I mean, it wasn't just like, you know, an election did it. You know, the election might have triggered a particular response in your friend in terms of her worries about, you know, Thanksgiving or something. But that's not, you know, that's not we overdoing it, or that doesn't explain why, really. So could you say who we are and why we, however we are defined, are overdoing it?
Sure. So by the we, I mean democratic citizens. And the book is driven largely by data that is collected in the United States and in the UK, but is and these phenomena are especially pronounced in those two democracies. But they're not exclusive to them. You can get similar kinds of data about democracies on the continent. And interestingly, you can get similar kinds of data in democracies where there is currently ascendant populist and nationalist movements, such as in the United States and in the UK. And so the book is about us as democratic citizens. Now, just to spell out, I want to sort of, there are three sort of findings, now talking particularly about the United States context, that I think are really revealing of our attitudes. So trust in government and its institutions and its officials is especially low for as long as Pew Research has been tracking these things. Past 10 years or so, we've seen a steady decline in sort of popular trust among the citizens in government to solve problems, to look out for the concerns of ordinary people, to get things done that serve the common good, so on and so forth. Similarly, cross-partisan hostility in the United States, that is animosity towards the other side, is especially intense. And by some metrics, cross-partisan hostility in the United States outstrips cross-racial and interfaith hostilities. And by the way, this is one of the metrics that's used as sort of attitudes about inter-party marriage. In the United States, inter-party marriage is more frowned upon than interracial marriage in the United States.
Wow.
That's interesting, right? Okay. Okay. So there are interesting data to this point. And let me say one other thing about the inter-party hostility. You know, it might not be, you might think, and you'd be right, like, well, you know, hating the other party is nothing new, and intensely hating the other party is nothing new either. And that's true, right? You know, my father hated Democrats, but his hatred for the Democrats was targeted at Jimmy Carter. Was targeted at the party leaders and the party, the candidates. What's become more intense and more pronounced, and what's relatively new for us as a citizenry, is that inter-party hostility has now sort of gone local. Now, the person who dislikes Democrats it does so more intensely, and the animosity is now more commonly targeted at rank-and-file citizens who happen to affiliate, not even our members, happen to affiliate with the other party. So the hostility has become sort of more local, more neighborhood, you know, more in the neighborhood, as it were, rather than aimed at or targeted at whatever happens to be going on at the Capitol or in Washington, D.C. So thirdly, we as a citizenry seem to all agree, as the majority, pretty broad majority of the citizenry in the United States today, agree that politics has become too fractured, too divisive. We're sick of all the animosity and rancor, and want to see more cooperation from our politicians. And something like 60-something percent of, close to 70% of people in a recent Pew study report this. Most of them also report that the reason why politics is so bad is because the people in the other party won't just capitulate. And so just think about that, those sort of three findings. There are others that we could talk about that are discussed in the book too. But you can just think of those three findings. You say, there is, if the democratic ideal does involve this this moral attitude, let's call it. I call it civic friendship in the book. This attitude of, within a broad spectrum of opinion, you know, there are liminal cases and we could talk about what they are. But within a broad spectrum of opinion, there's a lot of room for political rivalry among fellow equal citizens who deserve an equal say. That spectrum in our minds as citizenry is getting increasingly shrunk, such to, now to the point that we now report, not merely thinking that the other side is misguided politically and their policies are to be opposed. That's old news. Mm-hmm. We now report that we're now more than ever, at least since Pew has been doing this kind of research, certainly within the last 20 years, we're now more than ever likely to report that the other side, by which you just mean rank and file members of the other major party in the country, are positive threats to the American way of life. Now that's new. And that is a clear indication that civic friendship has fairly drastically eroded. And I don't think democracy makes any sense among civic enemies.
So I asked you why also. I mean,
so good. Yeah. So I think it's an important feature of the argument of the book. And it's on one hand a revealing sort of, if I'm right, this is a revealing a part of the thesis, but it's also, you know, independent of whether it's right, it's also sort of important for what I see as the broader story. You know, we're used to, and by the way, the bookstores are now filled with contributions to a genre about what's gone wrong with democracy that tell some version of the story that some non-democratic force has invaded the political sphere where it is unwelcome and actually has within it the seeds of democracy's undermining. And so this non-democratic force, usually capitalism or neoliberalism or commercialism or in some conservative circles, sort of atheism, sort of invaded the democratic sphere and started dismantling it from inside. The account I'm giving, though, tries to show that this vulnerability is internal to democracy itself. That is, the way that we get into a political situation where civic enmity is being fostered by our social interactions and engagements is by way of what I'm sure are sincere, authentic attempts to realize the democratic ideal. That is, the why question is, democracy is such an important, crucial social good. It is such an inspiring and dignifying aspiration that, like ideals and aspirations generally, we're always going to fall short of. But the falling short has led us to what looks to me just like an error of an error of sort of baby logic, right? The fact that we're falling short of an important aspiration doesn't entail that the right course of action is to redouble the effort, right?
Yeah.
And so built into democracy is this aspiration of self-government among equals. That's a worthy aspiration. Still, sometimes it's the case that if we want to best pursue our deepest and most important aspirations, sometimes we've got to aspire to other things in addition to it. Does that make sense?
I suppose. I was more thinking along the lines of, if we go back, 10 years or something, right, or perhaps a little longer, so this has been it didn't happen overnight. You know, this has just been building up, let's put it. Now we're kind of in a crisis of some sort, but so I'm just trying to wonder, trying to get some assessment of, why you think this has happened. I mean,
sure,
that's what I'm looking at. I mean, you don't really, yeah, discuss much in the book, almost not at all, any sort of economic trends that might be behind it or, other sorts of trends. And, So I was just wondering, you know, again, I mean, what is it that's bringing this about? Or do you have any thoughts about that? You know,
sure.
Why? Yeah.
Sure. So I think that part of the story here is the familiar story about the technology, the communications technology, the social media technology. That's surely part of the story. And I take it that listeners are going to be familiar with that aspect of it, the echo chamber, filter bubbly kind of
right.
Thought about it. And so part of the book is completely on board with roughly that kind of assessment. But I don't think that that can be the full story. I think that, and the, you know, the social factors that are ultimately the right causal explanation for this are very complicated. I don't know how to tell the story, actually. But surely one feature that is related to but distinct from the sort of social media, internet kind of filter bubble explanation is that and perhaps this is itself just one other ramification of the technology. The ability to exert control over our immediate environments. In the book, I give the example, you know, living in Reno no longer means that you have to give up fresh seafood. Right? You could be in the middle of a desert, right? And you know, have fresh seafood. The way that we can commute, the way that we can communicate over great distances in the way that you and I, Carrie, right now are, has meant that we as individuals exert more and more control over our immediate surroundings. And what that means is that the world that we inhabit is more than it was 10 years ago, even 15 years ago, for sure, surely 25 years ago. What that means is that our worlds are sort of increasingly made to order. By the way, just this afternoon, I got a new microwave oven from Amazon because, you know, the local Target just didn't have it. And so I went online in the Target store, went online, found it on Amazon, ordered it while standing in the, you know, standing in Target, and it showed up the next day. Now, there are all kinds of ways in which what a wonderful world we're in. In another sense, like, well, what this means is that we're more and more able to contour the world in our own image, which means now that because due to very complicated sort of social sociological factors, because our political activity and our political preferences have become so deeply intertwined with our lifestyle choices. By the way, just a side note on that, just think of how much of what passes for political critique these days really is just a matter of mocking consumer choices.
Well, I mean, I would, you know, just to, I mean, I think for a lot of people, you know, so if you think you're in Target, you order something from Amazon. I mean, I'm thinking about the people who, you know, who work at Target or right. who are in the Amazon warehouse, whose control of their lives is, you know, lower than ever because of, you know, scheduling by computers and, you know, other miserable, or they don't even have a job or they can't make ends meet and so forth. I mean, you know, I mean, there's you know, ample evidence as well of people who are in less control right. of their lives because they are completely not in control of their, you know, ability to work or do what they, you know, work or work as much as they'd like or work as much as they'd like at a job that they'd like, which is totally eroded. And so, you know, being able to be, it's true, you know, being able to, you know, click on a button and get a microwave the next day is an amazing bit of control that we didn't have 10 years ago. But I mean, the overarching, you know, sort of situation of you know, the majority of Americans, I mean, which we are not, you know, we're not in that really as tenured professors and what have you. I mean, we're kind of, you know, insulated from that to a great degree. But for most people, it's just not true that they're in greater control of their local environments. They're much less in control of their local environments.
Well, you're right that the sort of economic domination of larger and larger portions of the citizenry, this is a problem that has to be part of the full story. Now, you're right also that the control that workers exert over their lives, both on the job and, as is becoming the case, even outside of the job, where now employers, you know, claim an entitlement to control what people do on the weekends and, you know, whether they smoke and all these things, right? You know, the stuff that Elizabeth Anderson's most recent book is about, the private government book. This is all true, but note, one of the ways in which technology has shown up in that particular aspect of our national milieu is that that angst, that insecurity, those changes to economic prospects have all been transformed into a kind of lifestyle politics, into a kind of political identity. Now, of course, you know, you don't have to be Marx, you know, to have sort of views about false consciousness and the ways in which economic interests are sort of distorted and turned on their head, to see that that's got to be part of the story. You know, exposure to online sources that promote a particular view about the shape of the economic and political world and what's happening in it and who's to blame. These are no less used, visited, frequented by the people who are working at your local Walmart than they are the baristas who are, you know, have a second job as they're, you know, finishing college at the Starbucks. And so, at least in this respect, more and more of the world around us, even if you're, as I'll concede, you're correct to say, the level of individual control that we ourselves exert over it varies, perhaps markedly with various economic markers. But nonetheless, the turning of the everyday features of our life into expressions of and markers of our political loyalties, understood here as mapping onto not some utopian political thought about, you know, the democracy to come or about the egalitarian society to come, but those identities are tied to political partisan identities, travails, and hostilities that exist right here, right now, right? That's part of the story. It's not only that everything's become sort of an expression of our political identity. It's that our political identities are always focused right here, right now, on the political divides that exist right now as it's going on in real time. Just think, one sort of marker of this is the difference between, you know, you might not like, well, in fact, I know you carry well enough to, you don't like either of the things I'm about to mention, Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts.
I don't like right? them. I thought that
you didn't like Starbucks coffee.
I don't want to start plugging for Starbucks, but I actually like Starbucks because for a lot of reasons. So no, I have no problem with Starbucks.
Okay, well, just in the States, for those who might be listening who might be elsewhere, in the States, you know, it's clear that Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts are serving a different population of citizen. Starbucks is serving a clientele that likes the momentary illusion of speaking a foreign language, which is, you know, where they rip off all the names of the drinks are taken from foreign languages. The decorations are always scenes of faraway places. That Starbucks clientele skews liberal, which also skews cosmopolitan. You're more likely to vacation outside of the country if you're liberal, or it goes the other way. If you know your last vacation was someplace you needed a passport to go to, chances are very high that you are not conservative. Contrast that with the inside of a Dunkin' Donuts. Now, what's the Dunkin' Donuts slogan? Do you know? Have you been in Australia for too long to remember?
Yeah, right. no, I mean, we don't have a Dunkin' Donuts. I like espresso, so what can I tell you? You know,
the Dunkin' Donuts slogan, and has been for a couple of years now, is America runs on Dunkin'.
Okay.
So look, that's a clientele that's interested in coffee and carbohydrates because they want to be alert at work. Think about all of the what passes for political critique that mentions your lattes and espressos versus the kind of political critique that talks about attention Walmart shoppers.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway.
So look,
my coffee preferences. Yeah, you know,
look, it turns
watery
out that
coffee. I don't like watery coffee. So,
well, look, there. It turns out that where you get your coffee is also features that's highly correlated with your political leanings.
Yeah.
So that the person who's sitting next to you as you're drinking your coffee, or the person who's standing next behind you online that you might have a casual interaction with, is not likely to present you with anything that's going to be unfamiliar in a context where you have to recognize that the person is still a decent human being. That's the trouble.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, you know, just sort of to point out that, you know, a lot of times, you know, where Dunkin' Donuts and where Starbucks choose to put their outlets.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, we don't have a choice in that. They make their decisions about where they're going to put their, you know, franchises or whatever.
Right.
I don't have access to, you know, so even if I wanted to go to Dunkin' Donuts in certain places, I don't have a choice. I mean, that's not up to me. And so, you know, a lot of that, I sort of wonder if that sorting, you know, maybe there's some sort of a feedback loop there where,
well, sure.
You know,
yeah.
Dunkin' Donuts is, you know, they're going after a particular slice of the citizenry. That's where they're going to put their, where they're going to put their, you know, stores. And Starbucks is making a similar sort of a decision. You know, I mean, but if in New York, for example, I mean, you have both. And you'll have like people from, you know, these same sorts of people, you know, rushing in there to get coffee, or the little stands on the corner with their, you know, awful coffee. But still, you know, I mean, you get all kinds of people. You get the Wall Streeters, you get, you know, they're all there. But that's because it's New York.
And
you have all of them.
Yeah, and in the large in the large cities in the United States, these trends, at least with respect to certain consumer choices, are less pronounced. Note that throughout the country, I should say this, throughout the country, the trend about McDonald's and Burger King, there are no, right? You don't find these trends with the large, long-standing fast food. You do find them with places like Chipotle versus Chick-fil-A. And you already know what the valences are when I just say what they, yeah, just say Chick-fil-A versus Chipotle, you know. But the point just is, you know, that that in ways that are not always obvious to us, our everyday behaviors often both take on for us an expressive political function. And even in cases where they don't, for us, so much overtly take on that expressive political function, they're viewed by those who see us as politically other, as expressive of our politics, and as explicable by way of our politics. That is, the person wearing a camo shirt, you know, there's a lot of this that goes on in Nashville, I should say. There are places where you see a lot of people wearing camouflage. Often the camouflage also has a big American flag on it, so it subverts the subverts the purpose of the camo, because the purpose ultimately is not to camouflage you, it's to express a certain political leaning. And you can contrast that with, I talk about this in the book, the tote bags. You know, how many tote bags you have is a good signal of what your politics are.
Yeah. So let me, we're running out of time, actually. Yeah, unfortunately, we got off track on a discussion of coffee. But so you know, very quickly, I mean, you know, listeners will have to read the book.
Sure. It's a short book.
Which they should anyway, right?
Yeah.
But what do you recommend that we do? I mean, sort of briefly. I mean, I'm sorry about that, but. Yeah.
No. It's fine. So, you know, the core argument of the book really has to do with this polarization phenomenon. It would be one thing, you know, just it would be sort of regrettable were it the case that the country, you know, the citizens of a major democratic nation were kind of sorted into their own hives. But it turns out that that kind of sorting is also sort of cognitively disabling in a particular way. The belief polarization phenomenon really just is this sort of yes man phenomenon. You know, you interact more and more with people who are just like you. You become more extreme in your own commitments, more confident in your judgments, and you also come to hold more radical versions of those judgments. And so there's a whole chapter in the book just about the data about this belief polarization phenomenon. When you sort of fit that our vulnerability as it is to this belief polarization phenomenon, when you fit that into the broader sociological story about the political saturation of our social and local social environments, you'll see that every argument that listeners might be familiar with for the dangers of online echo chambers applies a fortiori for our everyday physical environments. The world around us is giving us louder and louder echoes of our own political voices. And that makes us more extreme. As we become more extreme, the people on the other side start looking more and more alien, incompetent, depraved, benighted, and we lose the basis for seeing them, regarding them morally as people who are entitled to the equality that by law they in fact enjoy. So that's the story. Normative or the prescriptive, we should say, sort of upshot of that story is ultimately that our overdoing of democracy has put us in this position. So the solution can't be more democracy. You know, John Dewey and Jane Addams are famous, you know, the cure for the ills of democracy is always more democracy. That's usually correct, perhaps. It's not correct in this case, that this is an autoimmune problem for democracy. And so the prescriptive upshot is we have to find, recapture, if necessary, build, forge venues for social cooperation, where our political allegiances are not merely bracketed or set aside or worse still suppressed, but rather that our political allegiances are simply beside the point. Just we have to find things to do together that are cooperative and pro-social, where just, you know, who the other people voted for who are participants in the activity is just something that doesn't come up, is not part of. We don't see in what we're doing an expression of our political valences. We just see what we're doing as aimed at something else, and politics isn't part of that. Now, I know listeners are thinking, what in the world could that be? And and I invite them to read the book, because I think that that's actually a face of the problem. That limitation on our imagination is itself the upshot of belief polarization under conditions of political saturation. It's not the counterexample. that's a symptom of the problem, that you couldn't imagine something of the sort I'm describing, is one of the problems. I'll give one last thing, I promise, on this. I once gave a talk about this, in one of the early versions, and somebody asked the question, well, what am I supposed to do? What do you recommend? And this is sort of part of the reason why the prescriptive stuff in the book doesn't come until the very end. And even there, it's sort of second order rather than directly prescriptive. You know, I give a description of the kind of thing you should try to do rather than a list of things you should do. So I said, well, look, you know, one thing that we might do to sort of help desaturate our local environment is, you know, why don't you volunteer to help clean up the litter in your local park? And the audience member looked at me and said, that's a liberal thing to do. And maybe he was right. So I thought, maybe the prescriptive stuff can't be on that order. It can't be just a menu. Here are a couple of activities to engage in. Maybe rather the prescription is, as I decided it should be in the book, there's a certain kind of thing one ought to do. Try to find something to do that you can, that you honestly don't regard as expressive of or signaling your political valences, mm-hmm. and see what happens.
Yeah, I tried. so let me, you know, I shouldn't, but very, very, very quickly, in Iowa, I thought, you know, let me take up something interesting and new, skeet shooting.
Oh my.
Yeah. Oh, I'm totally like down for, you know, this would be really cool. So I investigated.
I just didn't think you'd be into guns.
Well, I would, you know, it was like Iowa, probably guns, yeah, sure. you know, just go with the flow. I'm not going to kill animals, but
right.
Shooting clay pigeons, I'm totally, that'd be great. I mean, it's a great skill. So I investigated, how do you do this? And I found out that all the gun clubs were NRA gun clubs, which meant to join the club, you had to join the NRA.
Oh my, yeah.
Yeah, and that's apparently the way it works, right? That you either belong to an NRA gun club, which are apparently the majority, or you know, maybe there's a couple, you know, outlier clubs that are unaffiliated, but they're few and far between. So that was it. It's like, you know, I was not able to pursue something that in theory might have been a perfectly fine expression of my own sort of interest, and you know, not in any political way. I don't see why, you know, skeet shooting would necessarily be political.
Sure.
But the context in which I was, you know, could do it was political. I was not able to do it because it was beyond my control unless I wanted to join the NRA, which is what I was not going to do.
Of course, right. That's a good example of saturation, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway,
my wife and I started going to bluegrass concerts.
Oh, I think bluegrass is great. Anyway, so
which has worked out fine.
Yeah,
who knows how the people there at the station, and I'm assuming a lot of them are conservative, but I have no idea. We sit around and talk about the mandolin player. It's actually very cool.
So what's next for you? I mean, we are out of time. So very quickly.
Yeah, sure. The next thing is my often frequent, I should say, co-author and collaborator Scott Aiken and I have just are just finishing up a short book now called Political Argument in a Polarized Age. He and I worked together on sort of the intersection of democratic theory and social epistemology / argumentation theory. And so we've written a bunch of things on political disagreement and argument in a democratic society. And we have a new book that should be out in the spring that's about argumentation and the virtues of civility under conditions where we have good reason to think, even in our own cases, that polarization has impacted our judgments.
Good. Very good.
Yeah.
So, I wish you luck with that endeavor. And thanks again for talking to New Books in Philosophy about your new book, Over New Democracy.
Well, thank you so much, Carrie.
Okay. Bye-bye. You've been listening to my interview with Robert Talese, W. Alton Jones Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. We've been talking about his new book, Overdoing Democracy, Why We Must Put Politics in Its Place. That's forthcoming from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and thank you for listening.